All right, good morning, everyone. Today is the second and final. No, just for this series. I'm not moving anywhere. But I will be, as I mentioned last week, I will be away for the next 2 weeks. So the next series will start on the 27th of November.
There is, that's
correct, yeah. So we'll start again on the 27th of November. I don't know yet the topic. Sometimes I need
a couple.
Okay, I'm happy. Send me a WhatsApp with a couple of suggestions. Otherwise, I'll have to get some inspiration in New York next week. Okay. So, this Shabbos is, before we start, this Shabbos is the Shabbos Project. Probably many of you know that there's a Shabbos Project event tonight with Omer Shemtov, the hostage. You can still book after the shiur. It closes at 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. today, the booking. So if you haven't booked, chaparayin, as I say in Yiddish. So it's at Central. Yeah. So I want to, in the discussion today, we're doing the series about lessons learning from the hostages. I'm also going to bring in the Shabbos idea because that's actually very much connected, as we'll soon see. But before we do that, you know, I was just talking to a bunch of people last night. We had a Kayemet event, a young adult event, and I shared with them, we were going to give a discussion, but before that, I just shared with them some interesting positive stories. I think in the world we live in, it's important to highlight positivity. So, not directly connected to today's topic, but I want to just mention a few positive points. The first is a beautiful thing, before we do the review and do today's topic. So, I saw a beautiful thing, maybe you've seen it also. I'm on a WhatsApp that shares positive stories. There's a mall in Israel called Ayalon Mall. I don't know where it is, but apparently just recently they did such a beautiful thing. It's such like we have a beautiful nation. They closed the mall for a few hours in the middle of the night so that the hostages, 18 hostages, could come and shop without the hustle and bustle. A lot of them need their privacy and need to be. They just gave a few hours. They gave them vouchers, just amazing things. And they provided vouchers for different brands and just a beautiful gesture. I mean, it's a big mall, and these things are significant when you close the mall for a few hours, right? The other thing I was thinking about, I was reminded of a story yesterday, and someone mentioned something. The whole story of the hostages is an amazing story because we've been following them now for 2 years. Everyone's been thinking about them. Everyone's been praying for them. And when they came out during Sukkot, at the end of Sukkot, it just captured everyone. Like, everyone's talking about it. Every Jew. Like, all over the world, right? It's like become a very personal thing. And I was thinking about a story I just want to share with you. I don't know if I've ever shared this with you, but if you remember it, it's revision. There was, in 1913, in Kiev, there was the last documented blood libel, and it was famously known as the Bayliss trial. There was a guy called Mendel Bayliss, and he worked in a factory, and he was, actually, I just found out today, actually, this morning, I was just looking into it, that he actually came to New York and actually died in New York. He was actually buried in New York. Anyways, but he was accused of a blood libel, of slaughtering his Christian child, you know, the whole thing. And there was this massive, massive court case, which obviously was going to be slanted and very anti-Semitic. At the end, he won, but the whole Jewish world got involved, and a lot of Jewish leaders from all over the place got involved in this trial. And one of the things was that they knew that the prosecutors and the lawyers and things were going to not only bring evidence to accuse him and prosecute him, but also prosecute the Jewish people, essentially, right? And what they tried to prove is that the Jewish nation hates non-Jews, and they're disrespectful non-Jews, and therefore it's very plausible that he would have slaughtered that child. And one of the things he was going to bring, and it was known before, I think, a passage in the Talmud, where there's a passage in the Talmud, it's a very complex halachic passage, but the gist of it is that there's a particular law of shlichut, of how you can do certain things through proxy and so on, through certain mitzvot you can do through someone else. It's called a shaliach. But you can only do it if you send a Jewish shaliach. And the reason is because In that particular law, the Torah uses the word Adam, which is a person who will do the following, and we learn, and then it's hints that you can use someone else if you need to. And the Talmud says, which on the surface sounds like a strange concept, he said that Atem Kroim Adam, when I say Adam in the Torah, we're referring to the Jewish people. So they wanted to say, you see, for the Jewish people, other people are not considered people, right? It's only Jews. So they needed a good response to that, of course. And one of the great rabbis who sent them an explanation to explain the passage of the Talmud was a rabbi called Rabbi Meir Shapiro. He was a Rosh Hashiva. He was a great leader in Lublin. He built a big yeshiva there, famous yeshiva. The building is well known there. People go to Poland and actually visit the building. Oh, you stayed there. It's a hotel, right, or something, yeah. What people do, because actually one of the things this leader did was he founded the very famous program of learning called Daf Yomi. I don't know if you know what that is. Daf Yomi is a page a day, two sides a day of Talmud. You finish the whole Talmud in 7.5 years. So sometimes there are groups that go to Poland and they study the Daf Yomi. They go into the building and they study the piece of Talmud there to be in his building. Anyway, but he was a very, very smart man and he sent the following response back. He says, tell them the following. He says, if you look in the Torah in classical Hebrew, there are many words. First of all, it's ridiculous because if you see in the whole Talmud, there's so much about the respect for every human being created in the image of God and so on. But what is special about this one, Adam? He said there are many words in Tanakh or in classical Hebrew that refer to human beings, like Ish, Isha, right? Man, woman, Gever is a person also, different things, right? And then Adam. What's interesting is that all the words that stand for human beings, most of them, you have it in the singular form and the plural form. So for example, Ish is a man, Anashim is the derivative of Ish, is men. Isha is a woman, Nashim is women, right? Gever is a man, Gevarim is many, Gevira is a woman, same thing, the female of the Gever, and it's Gevirot. There's one that has no plural, and that's Adam. Why? He says, because human beings by nature are different from each other. When it comes to Jewish people, that's why they're called Adam, because actually they're not different. They're actually one family. And he went on, he said, add to that argument the following. And tell the judge, where do you see, in which nation and in which country, that one person goes on trial and the entire world feels it? He said, you should understand that when Mendel Bayless is on trial, everyone's on trial. Every Jew is on trial. And when Mendel Bayless was freed at that time, it was a celebration of every Jew. That's why Adam refers specifically to the Jewish nation. And I think you see this with the Haschal. I was just thinking about it the other day. It's an amazing thing. Like, it was just everyone's personal simcha. Everyone you talk to, I met somebody, people, the Sukkot, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it fantastic? And people shut up and they were connecting. Somebody went to shul and some chatara. And it was the most amazing celebration of who? Of every Jewish person. No one knows them. Maybe some of you do. I don't know any of the Haschal. But it doesn't matter. It's us. They were freed, we were freed. And that's how it works. Just a beautiful thing. One final thing I just saw yesterday, I'll just share with you, just such a nice thing. One of the hostages is called Guy Gilboa. Before October 7th, October 7th was, of course, Simchat Torah, which was after Sukkot. I was thinking about what my wife always tells me after Sukkot when I read this, I'll tell you in a second, but when just before Sukkot that year, he helped his father build a sukkah. And then October 7th happened, Shemini Atzeret. Ordinarily, he would have been taken down after Sukkot, and they didn't take it down. And they waited for him to come back. Just the hope, right? So he said, the story reads, the sukkah stood untouched in the Alfei Menashe yard throughout 730 days of captivity. Upon his return, there was a whole sort of ceremony. Guy took it down. He was going to take it down after that Sukkot, and they left it for him to take it down. Guy took it apart, surrounded by family and friends, then put on tefillin, and then screamed Shema Yisrael. So that was the latest sort of ceremony about the Hasidus. Okay. So, just to first of all review a little bit what we did last week, and I want to actually expand on the first topic, and that was, we talked about hope, we talked about faith, and we talked about faith even in darkness, and we talked about faith leading to action. I want to just go back to hope for a minute and just share with you a couple of ideas. First of all, I want to share with you an insight into this week's Torah portion. Famous little story with the three angels. The three angels come to Abraham. Abraham circumcised himself. He was recuperating. and upon God's instructions, and then he wanted guests because Abraham always liked guests, and the guests weren't coming. So because God had made it a very, very hot day, so guests shouldn't bother him. And he was sitting at the tent waiting for guests, and suddenly three angels, representing themselves as human beings, arrived. And they ended up being angels, and each one had a particular role. So one of them, at the end of the whole meal that they ate, and Avraham Avinu provided a beautiful meal for them. Do you know what the menu was, by the way?
Tongue.
Tongue and mustard. I always remember it because when I was a kid, it was one of the most beautiful delicacies my mother used to make for us. And whenever I used to laugh at it, I say, well, don't laugh at it because Avraham Avinu served that. Right? He served tongue and mustard. Besides other things, bread and other stuff. See, so even Avraham Avinu thought it was a good menu. Anyways, but so then one of them says to him, where's Sarah, your wife? See, so she's in a different tent. She's didn't join them. But she was listening, or she was overhearing what was going on. And he said, I am a messenger from God, and I'm telling you that next year, Sarah will have a child. I'll return, and Hineis ben Sarah ishtecha, there'll be a son born to Sarah, your wife, which of course was Isaac. And that's what happened. And the Torah tells us that Sarah heard this, and she started to laugh. And she said something to the effect, she was really an older woman at that time, and her medical, her natural cycle obviously wasn't there anymore. Naturally, of course, she was way past childbearing age. And it says, "Vatitzchak Sarah," and she said to herself, after my skin is no longer useful, that's more or less paraphrasing what the Torah says, and my husband is also older, and I should have a child. Doesn't make sense, right? Right after that, God says to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? You know, God wasn't that happy that she laughed. Like, doesn't she understand? God can do anything, right? God can do anything, and she will have a child. And I saw this week a beautiful explanation, because really it's a very difficult passage to understand. Sarah was an unbelievable believer. Sarah was, in fact, we learned from this week's parasha that Sarah's prophecy, level of prophecy, was even greater than Abraham. She wanted to do something Abraham didn't want her to do. And God said, Kol asher tomar alecha, Sarah, everything Sarah tells you, you should listen to. So what was bothering her? Like, what didn't she understand? Like, what, she didn't believe, she questioned the miraculous ability of God. It's very hard to understand that would be true. So there's a book called the Sarei Alafim, and explains it the following. It says a very beautiful explanation. It says, of course Sarah believed. But she was saying, she was laughing at something else completely. For her to have a child was something that you needed something completely fresh and new. Her body would have to change. She would have to become a new person, which actually happened, right? And she felt that if that's the case, she would have to do something similar spiritually in order to deserve that newness, in order to deserve that miraculous experience. She would have to become miraculous, spiritually speaking. What does that mean? So he says the following. He says, you know, sometimes when we do something, a mitzvah, let's say, right? The first time a bar mitzvah boy puts some tefillin, for example, right? It's an amazing simcha. I remember when I put on tefillin the first time, you know, you're excited, you do it with tremendous intent. Can I say that I'm still putting on tefillin the same way that I did when I was a mitzvah boy? Probably not. Try once in a while, but it's not the same, right? You know, we make shehechiyanu, you know, when we do a new mitzvah, we eat matzah and we make shehechiyanu. But a mitzvah that we do every day, someone washes their hands to eat bread, for example, or whatever the case is, a mitzvah people do daily, they don't necessarily have the same passion, the same newness as it was before, right? And that's what happens, like we get stale a little bit. Yeah, we keep doing the things that we do, but it becomes a little bit robotic, it becomes a little bit normal, it loses its enthusiasm, its passion, and so on. If you made a mistake for many, many years, it's hard to sort of all of a sudden switch around. All those things are difficult. So Sarah, in humility, I don't think it was true with Sarah, but in humility, she felt that she was a little bit spiritually stale. She was a very devout woman, and she was a prophetess and a person serving God, but she felt that she possesses a certain staleness in the service of God. So when she heard that she's about to have a son next year, she looked at herself and she says, after I've like withered away, she didn't mean her physical body, she meant her spiritual body. After I've become stale, after so many years, she was 90 at the time, right? After so many years of becoming more and more sort of less excited or more, a bit more stale in terms of our spiritual service to God, suddenly I'm going to become fresh. And I know that I need to do that in order to deserve that miraculous experience. And that's why she was laughing. She says, like, it's a joy. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to deserve it. Of course God could do it, but I need to do my part, and I don't think I can. And that was God's response. He said, "Hayipalei me'Hashem davar." He said, how could you think that? Is there ever something that God would stand in the way of a person's ability to become fresh, to radically change, no matter what age, to do something more exciting, or to become more excited about what we do? Do you think God lacks that ability to allow the person to do that? Do you think it's not embedded in the human ability to, no matter how many years we failed, or how many times we made a mistake, or how many years it hasn't worked, to suddenly change? Everyone can do that. That was the exchange. It wasn't about a lack of belief. But the Rav Shitzer Rebbe, a great Hasidic master, he said that this is also an explanation in a paragraph that we say every Friday night in Kiddush. Right? In Kiddush we say, I'll tell you what it means simply, but I'll tell you how he interpreted it. He said, "Tchila lemikra'ei kodesh zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim," which means that Shabbat is the beginning of the holy callings, which means it's the most important festival, it's the beginning of all the festivals. And we keep it because zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim, it is to remember the going out of Egypt. One of the things God gave us, to remember the going out of Egypt, right? He said, he gave a Hasidic interpretation of this phrase like this. Tchila, when a person wants to become the beginning, fresh, he wants to start fresh. Lemikra'e kodesh, for anything that's a holy calling. But he feels that he cannot do that. He or she feels that they're stale, too many years has gone by. Then on a lower level, they can't suddenly climb the ladder of spiritual enthusiasm. He said, you know what you have to do? Zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim. You have to remember the going out of Egypt. You know what the going out of Egypt was about? It was a Jewish nation that had sunken, Kabbalistically we are taught, that had sunken to the 49th level of impurity. Almost at the point of no return. And that didn't look like a nation that can suddenly go out of Egypt physically and spiritually, become God's nation. So if you want to start, you're not the first one. The Jewish people did it when you came out of Egypt. They did it, Zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim. There always has to be hope. Giving up is not an option. We always believe, no matter how far gone. Rabbi Akiva started to learn when he was 40 years old. And he became the Rabbi Akiva. He was illiterate till he was 40 years old. You can always start. You can always try. You can always become excited. You can always go out of your spiritual Egypt. You can always change. You can always become more enthusiastic. Zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim. You just have to remember the going out of Egypt. Which leads into a story that I heard on video. I don't know if he's going to say it tonight, but if he does, I've only stolen 2 minutes of the session. But I did hear from a beautiful story of Omer Shem Tov. He tells the following story. When he was in Gaza in the tunnels, there was some operation that the army had above ground. And when the army left, you know, some of the boys in the army, a lot of them were in the army actually quite learned, and they use every spare moment they can to actually study Torah, even in Gaza. I mean, there's amazing stories about that, a different topic, but amazing stuff. And when they finished the operation and they left some Jewish books. This happened to the one I mentioned last week also, Agamberg as well. But and one of the books they brought to Omer Shem Tov, and it was a publication. It's a weekly Chabad publication. It looks like this. This is what it was. I get this every week. It's called Dvar Malka. What it is, interesting book. It has weekly studies. It's got the Parsha of the Week. It's got some Rambam to study. It's got some Chassidut to study. It's got Law. It's got Talmud. Everything. So, like, you know, if you're traveling, for example, it's really good. Or if you're on the go, whatever. So I do a daily Chumash. I do a daily Rambam. It's in here. So I use it a lot. So he got one of these books. And he opens it up. And it's the Parsha dealing with Yosef. Joseph. That's what he tells. And it's the part, a bit well into the story of Joseph. Must have been Miketz, I guess. I think the story of Miketz, probably. That's the Parsha. And he got very excited, and they saw he's getting excited, so they wanted to take it away from him. So he said, please don't take it away from me. I'll do anything you want. I'll clean for you. I'll cook for you. And he ended up doing that. He had to actually work hard in order to keep this book. And he opens it up, and he sees the story of Yosef. And he sees, he wasn't that versed in Chumash until then. He sees that Yosef was a hostage. He was 10 years in jail, in a dungeon. That's what it says. And then he reads, one day, the whole thing with the dreams and everything, and then he reads that one day Paro had this dream that he couldn't interpret, and the butler said, you know, I was in jail with this guy, and right? And don't forget, Yosef was in, like, Rindakasri, he was distanced from his whole family, he had no idea what's happening with his family. I mean, nowadays they didn't have any idea what's happening with their family because they didn't let them have any access to news, but those days there was no news, right? It was just, he was in Egypt, he was far away, and he was sitting there not knowing what's happening, he didn't even know if anyone remembered him even, right? And then he reads in the Chumash that Paro sends for Yosef, and within one little story, in one day, from being a forsaken, forgotten prisoner in a dungeon of Egypt, Yosef becomes the viceroy of Egypt. And he thought to himself, that's it? This is the story. This is for me. This is my answer. I'm here. I'm in the tunnels. I don't know who remembers me, but it can happen in any moment. And that's what kept him going the whole time. That's what gave him hope. And eventually he came out. Didn't become the viceroy of Egypt, thank God, but because it wouldn't be a very good position today anyway. But he's well known and he's inspiring people. He's going to inspire us tonight, hopefully. So that's what hope is all about. The Torah is full of these things, right? And I think what we've learned in the modern day time with them is that hope keeps a person going, and hope is something we can never forsake. There's no giving up. There's no despairing. There's no being despondent. That's just the DNA of being Jewish. So that was the first thing we spoke about last week, the hope. Then the second thing, of course, was faith. And the third was, if nizkarim v'nasim, when you remember something, you have to action it. And that's why they are doing that in a very big way. We need to sort of do that as well. Okay, so let's cover just a few points that we didn't cover last week so strongly. Some of them are things that we've spoken about before, but it just comes out amazingly in the stories that we've read from the hostages. So, I mean, reading that book from Eli Sharabi came out, and I got my copy, and it's called The Hostage. I'm not finished yet, but we're getting there. And I read there that one of the periods when he was there, he was with someone who later, unfortunately, was killed, but the famous Hirsch Poland Goldberg. And they landed up in a tunnel together. And that was when he said he heard the line, which Hirsch Poland said, actually, that Viktor Frankl would say all the time, quoting it from one of the previous philosophers, that those who have a true why to live can bear with almost any how. And he heard that. And he said, and he writes, that became his, and we see a lot of Viktor Frankl coming out in his journey, and that became his anchor all the time that he was in, all the hundreds of days that he was in captivity. Now we know that, as I said, Viktor Frankl's teachings was really so much emphasized in the story of many of the hostages. As we've spoken about at length, we did a whole series of Viktor Frankl recently, and of course, the ideas that he speaks about is very, very much in line with Jewish thinking. But it's the idea of having a why to live. Now, of course, in Judaism, that's an easy thing, really, because the why is there. The values, the meaning, right? The idea of living with the meaning. Now, in Sharabi's case, he lived for his faith, he lived for his identity, he lived for his family, which unfortunately actually weren't around. But that was gave him strength in order to really go on, in order to really live. And the idea behind that is that, and we've spoken about this many times before, but it's such an important thing to always bear in mind. Circumstances change, your value and your meaning doesn't change. So in life, we go through so many different circumstances, so many different experiences. Some of them are good, some of them aren't good. Some of them are smooth, some of them are challenging, right? And sometimes we go through periods of uncertainty, periods where we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We're not sure what's going to be. We're not sure what the outcome's going to be. Those are uncertainties that always happen, but they happen in the world of the things that we do. With me? It doesn't happen in who we are. It happens in the things that we are surrounded by, or the things that we're trying to accomplish, the things that we're trying to achieve. Those things change. They're not constant. Our livelihood is not constant. Sometimes our relationships are not constant. Our experiences are not constant. The cycle of wealth is not constant. Nothing is constant. Politics is not constant, that's for sure. But nothing is the same for always. And we shouldn't even pretend that it can be or will be, because it's not. And that's why often we go into an anxious state of uncertainty. We go through periods that we worry because we don't know what's going to happen, right? And uncertainty, by the way, is a very, very bad thing for a person. I know this from the Talmud. Going back all the way to the Talmud says, "Ein simcha kehatarat asfekot." There is no greater joy than the clarity of doubt. Being uncertain is very debilitating. But when a person moves from the experience of circumstance to the experience of identity and value and meaning, you enter into the world of certainty. Are you with me? In other words, no matter where you are, your values don't change. If you value to be a good person, you can be a good person in any circumstance. If you value to be kind, you can be a kind person in any circumstance. Right? If you value to help other people, to be a spiritual person, to be a godly person, to nurture faith, whatever your values are, those never change. They stay the same. Right? They stay exactly the same. Edith Eger once wrote, when we did it, you remember, the parting words of a mother was to say, they can take everything away from you, but they cannot take what's in your head. And what lives in our head? Our perspective, our values, our perspective on life, our outlook, those don't change. What does change is how we apply them and how we live them and what the actual practicalities of living them is. And therefore, this goes very, very deeply to the concept of if you have a why, you can overcome anyhow because the why is there. The why stays. Viktor Frankl always writes that when he was in the concentration camp, he would imagine himself back in a classroom lecturing on logotherapy. Right? He had all these things that he would think about all the time that were with him all the time in his head. They weren't with him physically, but they were with him in his head because they don't change. And in generally in life, this is such an important thing because when we move away from the world of the things that we are doing or the circumstances we're experiencing and we move into the world of our values, we don't have doubt. The doubt's still there. What's the circumstance going to be? But that's not me. What is me is the why. What do I stand for? Why am I living? What am I supposed to accomplish in this world? What are my values? And they stay constant. They become clear and they remain clear. Sometimes even stronger in the face of challenge. Right. Which I said, I wanted to move into the concept of, this coming weekend is the Shabbat project, and I've said this many times, but let's go through it again. Because that's what the whole relationship we have with Shabbat and the weekday. It's been said many times that the weekday is a time of doing, and Shabbat is a time of being. We're supposed to do less on Shabbat, right? We're supposed to be less engaged with a lot of the physicalities of the world. Why? Because that's exactly what Shabbat is. Shabbat is a time, during the week, is a world of doing. We do things. Everyone does something different. Everyone has a different job, a different role, a different experience. But we're doing a lot. We're running around on the treadmill of life, right? But and it's so strong, especially nowadays, that people keep rushing from one doing thing to another, that we stop. We don't always stop and think, why am I doing this? What's guiding me? What's pulling me? What guides or what pushes, what inspires the world of my world of doing? Now let's make no mistake, the world of doing is very important. Circumstances are important. We need to accomplish. We need to be responsible. We need to take care of our health. We need to do lots of things in this world. But why? Why are we doing it? And therefore we are given Shabbat because Shabbat is a space to ask why. Shabbat we're supposed to stop, spend time with our family, connect, spend time with ourselves. Spend time with a bit more Jewish learning. That's what Shabbat is. We go to shul. We hear the Torah reading. It's just a time to shut off, disconnect from a bit of technology, from other things, and reflect and be with ourselves and say, why? Why do I do this? What are the values? Right? That's what Shabbat is. That's why we stop. We have to stop. It's about stopping. In fact, the word Shabbat means to stop. People always think it means to rest. It does. But it actually comes from the word to stop. Shabbat means full stop, right? And that's the concept, that's the relationship. And then the concept, the idea is that when we go through that process each week that we stop, we've created a pause, which nowadays people don't do very much at all, but we've created a pause and we reflected that, the idea then is to take that in the week. The week is very important. Don't forget there's 6 days of the world of doing, and only one day of Shabbat, right? Because we're not supposed to just be constantly in a state of being because we have to get stuff done. We've got a lot to do. Especially when we ask ourselves why and we understand what our purpose is in this world and what our values are, what to do even becomes more. There's a lot to get accomplished. There's a lot to influence, there's a lot to inspire, there's a lot to do in this world. But we go into the 6 days and we do those, but we do it with the inspiration of the previous Shabbat, and then when we get stale again, we go into the next Shabbat. That's how the cycle works, right? I want to just explore this a little bit and take it back to something I noticed. I noticed lots of unbelievable things with the hostages connecting more to their faith and to mitzvot and so on. But there's three mitzvot that stand out, I mean, besides prayer, but there's three things that stand out for me that keep on coming up in different videos and stories and things like that. One is the Shema. Them saying the Shema. Not only them saying the Shema, but there's that story, I don't know if, that was told, on the October 7th memorial at Dover Heights. I've forgotten his name now, but it was that fellow that his sister died, I think, in the kibbutzim. And, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I've forgotten his name. Anyway, and he said, one of the stories he likes to retell is that when the army came for them, eventually, after many hours, the army came to the kibbutzim, and they knocked the doors. People who had still survived didn't want to open the door because they suspected they were terrorists.
Yeah,
and even, sorry? Yeah, and one of the things they did was they said, they even talking Ivrit didn't help. Because everyone knows that some of the Gazans can speak Ivrit too. It didn't help. What helped? When they said the Shema. And they said the Shema. It's a beautiful story. But a lot of the hostages also, like this guy took down the sukkah. After the sukkah, he said the Shema. There was one guy, I've forgotten who was, I think I told you last week, then when he left, he said he had this dream of, you know, because they used to parade monsters on stages, like giving him a whole ceremony of goodbye kind of thing. And he said his dream was to get on the stage and scream Shema Yisrael. Mm-hmm. Right? It's an amazing thing. The other one among the males is a very big surge in tefillin, the mitzvah of tefillin. Yeah. And the third one that seems to be a very common theme is the Shabbat, Adir Shabbat. Connecting the Shabbat everywhere in a different way, but connecting the Shabbat much more than before. There was... Maybe it was Omer Shemta, I don't know. There was one who had saved a drop of grape juice. There was another group of hostages that they sang Shabbat songs every Friday night. They didn't have any challah or wine or anything, but they sang Shabbat songs. There was another one that really wanted to connect with Shabbat, so he made Kiddush on water. Did his best he can. There's no grape juice. That's what he did. He did his Kiddush on water and so on. And I was thinking about it, that these three things actually have a common theme. An amazing common theme, which connects to this idea of connecting the being and the doing. So let's talk about the Shema. And we've talked about this before, but I want to connect it to this concept. And going back to this idea of having your focus, having a value-based life. So when we say the Shema Israel, we say, what does it mean? It's by the way, the Shema Israel was said by Moses, given to the Jewish people just before they went into the land of Israel. Right? Interesting enough, even though it's such a sentence that, I mean, it's part of the Torah, of course, and it comes from the God, but it wasn't given at Mount Sinai, so to speak. It was given to a nation that was about to go into the world of doing. See, the Jews, when they were in the desert for 40 years, they very much existed in the framework of being, not doing. They didn't have to do anything. They didn't have to work for their bread. It came from heaven. They didn't have to do their laundry. The clouds of glory took care of that. They didn't have to worry about mountains and snakes and scorpions that were threatening them. The clouds of glory flattened everything and killed the snakes and scorpions. They were just connecting with God, learning Torah, whatever they were doing. So it was very much a full-on Shabbat experience for 40 years, every day, all day, 24/7. And then Moshe Rabbeinu is prepping the Jewish people to go into the land of Israel towards the end, which is the book of Deuteronomy. It's the book of Dvarim. So you know, it was the longest rabbinic speech ever. Do you know that? Right? He spoke for 37 days. So next time... Moshe Rabbeinu spoke for 37 days. The book of Dvarim. Next time you complain about your rabbi going 5 minutes over time. Just remember, it could have been worse. No, I'm just kidding. But, so, the amazing things, the book of Deuteronomy. I mean, it's part of the Torah. Obviously, it was divinely inspired. It wasn't just he made it up. But it was Moshe Rabbeinu's words, and he spoke to them. One of the paragraphs he talked to them was the Shema. Why was that so important all of a sudden? Why wasn't it important 40 years before? Because one of the ideas, I mean, there's many ideas. One of the ideas of the Shema is like this. We say, Shema Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem is our God. Hashem Echad, Hashem is one. Literal translation is that there's one God, right? But of course, the commentaries ask the question, why is it so important? I mean, it's not so hard to believe there's only one God and that all the idols and other religions are not really authentic. But, you know, one God, okay. But it's much deeper than that. Because the question is asked, I mean, why do we need... Actually, you know, in prayers and stuff, it comes out that if you do all the prayers properly and something, it comes out, you end up saying Shema a number of times a day, right? Just that's how it works, every day. Is that important? Just to convince ourselves that... you know, that Muhammad's religion wasn't good. I mean, like it's, you know, it's not that hard. But it actually means much more thing. It's much deeper than that. Hashem Echad means not that there's one God, but that there's oneness because of God. In other words, that there's really one reality. In other words, that everything comes under the creation and the guidance and inspiration of one being. That everything we do becomes godly, that we bring God into everything in our life, and our life becomes a life of oneness connected with God. And you'll probably remember, because I've done this many times, but I've given you the analogy of an orchestra, right? God created a symphony in this world. Many, many, many different instruments. It's a fragmented world. And we live a very, very fragmented life. We're doing different things. We're pulled in different directions. We have different priorities, different demands, different expectations from different people. And sometimes it becomes very hard to manage. We're not sure what is more important, what's less important. What are we supposed to be doing? What are we not supposed to be doing? What's our path in life? And so on and so forth. But just like an orchestra, if different instruments play together out of sync, it's horrible. It clashes, right? Would be the worst thing to listen to. And yet when you go and you watch a symphony, it's the most beautiful, melodious, harmonious experience. It's unbelievable. Why? Because they're following the conductor. And they're playing to one symphony and one melody and one focus, right? So that's what Hashem Echad means. Echad means it's made of three letters. Aleph, Chet, Dalet. Aleph is God, the one God. Chet is it says it's the seven heavens and the earth, because we have a belief the seven heavens and then the earth. That's eight. And Dalet is four, the four directions of the world. In other words, Chet and Dalet is the fragmentation, symbolize the fragmentation of creation. Everything's different. There's seven heavens, there's one earth, there's four directions. And this is what our life looks like sometimes. We're not sure which heaven we're in, we're not sure which direction we're going. It's all over the place. But if we connect it to the Aleph, it becomes one. It becomes a symphony, in fact. It becomes beauty. And that's what life is all about. Hashem Echad. And that's difficult. That's difficult to have God as our conductor every moment of the day. God and His values and His teachings to say, okay, what does God want me to do here? What does the Torah want me to do, right? And create that focus and that foundation of oneness in our life so that permeates everything and we create oneness from the turmoil and the fragmentation. We create oneness out of the whole turmoil. We create one harmonious sense of being. Not easy. It's not an easy thing. That's why we say Shema every day. Because that's a much more difficult challenge, just believing that there's one God. Of course it means there's only one God. True, that's obviously, and that He's the source of all blessing and the source of everything, but it's much deeper than that. And He's that the conductor of everything, and everything inspired by Him, right? And that's Shema. And that's the idea of Tefillin as well, by the way. Tefillin is the words of the Shema, in the Tefillin, of course. And Tefillin is put on the Torah says, put it on your hand and your eyes. The hand doesn't mean here, it means here, right? The bicep, which is near the heart. And on the head, which is near the brain. And then we do it seven times on the arm and three times on the finger, which represents action, our behavior, the things that we do. And the idea is to sync everything together. One of the ideas of Tefillin is the same idea. To sync, because sometimes we believe one thing, but we do something else, and we feel different emotion, and we're inside of us, we're all fragmented. So Tefillin is very much the same idea as Shema, and that's why we actually read the Shema when we say Tefillin, and the Shema is in the Tefillin, because that's the idea, to sync what you think, to take your heart, your head, your behavior, and bring it under a banner of oneness. And that's one of the deepest ideas behind Tefillin, and again, the same message as Shema, which of course goes back to the whole idea of Shabbat. Because Shabbat is that concept of being. It's the idea to stop so that when we go into the fragmented world on Shabbat, everyone's doing the same thing, right? Everyone is not, the plumber doesn't do the plumbing and the businessman doesn't do business and whatever people are doing, they stop doing it on Shabbat. That's the idea, to disconnect from the world of doing and to live in the world of oneness in order to create oneness, not on Shabbat, because that's easy, but in order to create oneness during the week when we go into the world of fragmentation. To bring the Hashem Echad into that world of fragmentation. Which is, by the way, on the topic already, so let's just share with you a Kabbalistic idea that we learn in Kabbalah. We know that God created the world through the medium of speech, right? Dibur. Now, obviously it's not physical speech, but it's the concept of speech, right? So if you look in Bereshit, in Genesis, you'll see when God created the world, everything is about God said that to be him, God said that to be this, God said that to be that, for Yomer Elohim, right? Shabbat, it says that God created the world in 6 days, and in the seventh day, he rested. Now, right, that's the Kiddush. We said that every Friday night in Kiddush, right? Vayishbot b'yom ha-shvi'i, he rested or he stopped in the seventh day. Now, the first question, of course, is, does God need a rest? I mean, maybe for us it's difficult to create things. It seems not difficult. It doesn't need a rest, right? It doesn't need a break. Secondly, what does it mean he stopped? We know this concept that Baal Shem Tov taught, that God didn't create the world only once. He recreates the world every moment. The world requires continuous recreation, which, by the way, is very good news, because that means every moment is a fresh moment. Another topic, but it means this newness that we can bring into every experience. Okay, we can discuss, we can get rid of the past and the baggage and all that stuff, and we can start fresh every day, every moment, actually. But bottom line is that he recreates continuously. Well, if he stopped on the Shabbat, then how does the world exist on Shabbat if he doesn't create, right? Doesn't seem to make sense. So the Kabbalists explain the following. Beautiful idea. Of course he creates on Shabbat, but the world is different on Shabbat. There's an ability, there's an energy on the world in Shabbat that's very different to the rest of the week. How so? We say that on Shabbat, the world elevates itself from the world of speech to the world of thought. Okay? What does that mean? So what does speech mean? What does it mean that God created the world with speech? What does that mean? So let me give you the following sort of scenario, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with, right? Let's say you have a very powerful thought all of a sudden, right? That just came to you in a flash. It's like you can't even put it into words yet before you think about it, but it's a very powerful feeling, let's say, right? Now you want to share it with someone else. You cannot share it with someone else in the same way that you're feeling it and experiencing it. You need to dilute it a bit. You need to break it down. So you break it down into a half an hour speech. You break it down into words, into sentences, into paragraphs, right? Each word is separate from the other word. Each word is different from the other word. Each paragraph is distinct from the other paragraph. Now, if someone just looks at the paper, let's say you document it, and someone looks at the paper and you start reading a few words, you have no chance yet of understanding the common theme that created all these different letters. Correct? Yeah, that makes sense?
Yes.
Hopefully, if you understand, hopefully it's been well written, hopefully if you have some insight into that person or what they're trying to get across, once you finish the entire essay or the entire presentation, you might get a glimpse of what inspired this entire paragraph with all these different words and different paragraphs and different letters. You get the common theme, right? That common theme was actually in your head or in your heart in a split second as one theme, as one concept before it started. So that it was a one idea. It's just in order to communicate it to the outside world, you have to fragment it in so many different words and letters. Right? God created a world by design, a fragmented world, which is why the world took place. God didn't think, let there be a world or let there be a heaven or trees. He said it. Because he wanted it to be fragmented. He wanted us to look at the world and not see the connection on the surface. And to see difference, and to see there's a tree and there's an animal, and everyone's different from each other. And this is one person, there's a different person, like the Talmud says. There are no two people that think alike and look alike. And we're just going to notice the fragmentation. And when you notice fragmentation, the next thing that comes after you notice fragmentation is you notice the clash that is happening between these different instruments or these different letters, different things, that they're not working in sync, right? And then he said, what I want you to do is, I'm giving you a mission. God created a world where he's not obvious, where the conductor is not visible, where the one thought, the one theme that is behind the entire creation is not apparent. And he said, then I'm giving you the Shabbat at the end of it all. Because what you need to do is Shabbat, you have to move away from the fragmentation. Shabbat, of course, God is creating on Shabbat, but he's creating through thought, not through speech. Because on Shabbat, what he's doing is, he's allowing us to tap into the oneness. He's allowing us to tap into the common theme. That it's the doctor is not a doctor, and the lawyer is not a lawyer, this person is not a plumber, this person is not a cook, this person is not this, this person is not that. They're all under oneness. They're all living a life of values, achieving the same thing, maybe doing something else, but achieving the same purpose. To make the world a better place, to bring God into the world, to do mitzvah, to elevate ourselves, to help other people, to be kind. There's a sense of oneness. Where do we get the inspiration to see the thought behind the essay? On Shabbat. Because Shabbat is the world of thought, not the world of speech. So it's the same idea. Being in a state of being rather than doing allows us to then create that oneness, to bring that oneness. What is the oneness that's guiding everything that we do? And that's why I just thought of this concept that it's such a combination between these various mitzvot that are specific. I mean, there's so many different mitzvot, right? But there's these mitzvot that are emerging for some reason. The Shema, the Tefillin, the Shabbat, because they all have to do with faith. All have to do with that faith in the Hashem Echad, the oneness of God. Anyway, I thought I'd share that with you, because to me it's quite inspiring. I just want to finish with one more point, and that is the following. And this is coming out of a lot of videos that I've seen of the Hashchas, but particularly this book, the reading of Elisha Rabbi. And that is, and it's connected, of course, to what we said before, but it bears highlighting it. And that is the choice to live, choosing life. Right? In Elisha Rabbi's story, it happened twice. First of all, it happened when he was in captivity. That tragically has a very, very tragic ending to his... I mean, he came out, and that was amazing, and he was freed, but as you probably know, he has a very tragic end to the whole thing, that he lived to be able to see his two daughters and his wife. And they were all murdered, which he didn't know. And of course, I can't imagine how devastating it must have been after holding on with such hope, and then to find out that they're not there. It's devastating. But he went through the process, and he made a decision not to be a victim. You can be victims in many, many ways. Victimhood is a very big disease, very common today. One of the common diseases. Victim means you blame everyone else, and you feel sorry for yourself and self-pity, and you wallow in that self-pity. Just last night, I was talking about it with this group of people, and one girl asked me, you know, she liked the whole idea, but she said sometimes she's very tempted to feel upset with us, you know, to feel sad. She wants to feel sad. But, you know, that's true, because we all do that. But so I said, it's fine for a day. Let yourself do it for a day or two. But then you've got to move on. Why? Because we've got to choose life. We've got to take responsibility. We've got to own our own experience, right? Because just like Joseph did, he didn't give up hope. And he, as we said before, and he was not a victim. He didn't blame this one and that one and wallow in that victimhood. He kept going. He chose life. It's a very, very fundamentally Jewish thing, choosing life, right? And choosing life means the ability not to be a victim to anything, not to be a victim to your circumstance, not to be a victim to your tragedy, to your challenge. These things are very difficult, but that's the choice that we have, the choice of resilience, the choice that we really have deep down. There's two, I might have shared this with you, but there's two, if I think of someone that really loved life, I think often of my mother, Leah Shalom. Bless memory, right? She was a person that really loved life. And even though she used to tell me two things, there was two lines that she often told me, especially towards the end of her life, where she suffered tragedy and hardship. And I always used to be worried about her. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story quickly before I tell you what I want to tell you. She's never worried about stuff. So she, in the previous house, the house that I grew up in, which we eventually moved out of when my father passed away, because it really wasn't a good area. And towards the end of her stay there, she got mugged when she got attacked one day. Very, very badly. They put her on the floor. She's an older woman, and they tied her up with straps, and it was like really bad. And of course, we heard about it. And then eventually, a neighbor happened to come in, and the guy ran away. It was like a whole miracle. And what was the sentence? Yeah, she. And then, of course, everyone was really worried. We all out of the world. We started calling. And we said, are you okay? Maybe you need to see someone. And she says, are you crazy? She says, everyone's telling me I need, what's the post-trauma therapy? My kids need post-trauma therapy. I don't need it. that was how she was like. So she used to tell me that. So afterwards, you know, my brother passed away and her niece passed away, her granddaughter passed away. She had a lot of challenges at the end of her life, and she was always got up and she was resilient and she was happy. She loved life. And I asked her, like, how do you do this? So the one line she always tell me is, so what do you want me to do, to sit in the corner and mope? That was a line. And then she had a line from my grandmother, apparently, because it was after two people had passed away, very close people. She said that her mother used to say, "Die lebedicke leben," which means those that are alive, live. You know, if you're alive, you're alive, so live it. Yes, it's hard. Not that she wasn't oblivious to the pain. The pain was tremendous. But and she told me that many times, that it's every day. But nevertheless, this idea of choosing life. But on a very deep level, this idea of choosing life is so powerful, because in Judaism we know that we have laws and we have things that are so in the direction of the sanctity of life. To keep a person alive for another hour, you're allowed to break Shabbat and all mitzvot. There's so many decisions and halachic complexities that we do because we want to keep people alive. We always choose life. Life has a tremendous sanctity. Even though Jewish thinking really believes in the eternity of the soul, for example, right? So we believe that a person dies, God forbid, they're not really, they're eternal. The soul is eternal. And yet, we fight for them to be alive in a very, very tremendous way. And one of the reasons for that is because what is the definition of life? The definition of life represents the entire purpose of creation. Life, halachically and philosophically and spiritually, is the combination of a body and a soul. Right? A combination of body and soul. A combination of something which is very godly and very spiritual and very deep with something that's very physical. In fact, when God created the human being, He waited till the sixth day. He first created a form out of the lowest form of creation, which is clay, dust, the dust of the earth. That's how the body was originally formed. And then God blew into that clay a soul of life. So it was the combination of something that is the highest form of existence, the neshama, together with the lowest form of existence, which is the body. And when that combination happens, the body becomes holy. The combination becomes holy. In other words, the concept of life actually represents the purpose of creation, which is to merge and to bring together the godly and the physical. That's what we're here for. We live in a mundane and physical life, and our purpose is to bring godliness in life, to bring meaning into that life, to bring purpose to that life. Yes, when the soul and body eventually separate, that's what we call death. The body, the place of the burial always remains holy, the soul eternal, that's true, but they're separate. And therefore they're no longer able to do that job and that role that God gave us. Other things happen, they take a journey and there's beautiful things, but they're no longer able to do that. And that's why we value every second of life, because it's that short time on this earth that we're able actually to fulfill what we're doing. We're able to join the soul and the body. So on an emotional level, it's the concept of resilience, the concept of not being a victim, it's the concept of choosing life, but also remembering, reflecting on the depth of what it means to choose life, because choose life actually means not to waste a life. To choose life doesn't mean just to exist. Choose life means to live a life of meaning where we combine the body and the soul. So those are a few. So again, so I think, what did I say? The 27th of November will be the new one. Topic to be advised. Waiting for the WhatsApp. Don't forget. And sorry?